This time of year, a good hoodie is absolutely essential, but it's tough to find one that will last through the season. That's why the American Giant Classic Full Zip Hoodie is made to last a lifetime, so you can count on it to bring you comfort and warmth year after year. Slate Magazine called it the greatest hoodie ever made, and from cotton to zipper, it's made right here in the USA. With timeless style, heavyweight fleece, a double-lined hood, and reinforced elbow patches, you can depend on it for years to come. Snag the hoodie that will bring you comfort for life, the American Giant Classic Full Zip, and save 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com when you use code CLASSIC24 at checkout. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com, code CLASSIC24.
Experience holiday cheer at Tanger Outlets with savings up to 70% off your favorite brands. From fragrances to accessories and the latest styles, discover the best gifts for everyone on your list. Save big at Nike Factory Store, Michael Kors, Under Armour, Coach, Polo Ralph Lauren, Kate Spade New York, and so many more. Unwrap the best at Tanger Outlets. Hundreds of brands, endless gifting options. Plan your trip at Tanger.com.
Please be seated. The jury has returned to the courtroom. Thank you for your patience, ladies and gentlemen. The objection to the exhibit is sustained. Mr. Eichhoff?
Your Honor, we have no more further question of Mr. Kerr.
All right, thank you. And there was no recross of Mr. Kerr? All right. Any additional witnesses, Mr. Eichhoff or Mr. Cotton?
No, Your Honor.
The defense rests?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. Any rebuttal?
No, Your Honor.
All right, thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, the evidence is now closed. For those of you not familiar with this procedure, because the state has the burden of proof, Mr. Lassay will make his argument first, then Mr. Cotton will argue his case, and then Mr. Lassay will have a chance to present rebuttal argument. Mr. Lassay? Okay, Mr. Johnson?
Ladies and gentlemen, I just want to tell all of you right up front, thank you for your patience during the last 3 days, and most importantly, your attention. I know it's a strange thing to be masked like this. It's more difficult, but we appreciate your patience and attention. When this case began, Mr. Lassay told you in the opening kind of what to expect to hear, just an outline of the evidence. And I think Mr. Lassay talked about a horror movie, but unfortunately, it's not a movie. And when I begin, I thought about what a horror movie involves. A horror movie basically is very disturbing and scary, graphic, brutal. There's usually killing, it involves weapons a lot of times in these movies, knives or other weapons. When the movie ends, you can turn on the lights, shut off the TV, and it's done. On June 7th, 2016, at 1368 Riverdale Drive, it wasn't a movie. You can't just turn on the lights and make it stop and go away. What happened to Sabrina Teague, Hee-san, or Sonny Teague, what happened to Joel Kennedy was real. Make no mistake, it was a real horror what happened. It involved still killing of two people, two human beings, an attempted killing of another human being. It was still just like a horror movie, brutal, graphic, involved weapons, involved a tire iron and a knife, a lot of blood, there was DNA and a confession. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to use a PowerPoint that's going to be up on the screen just to help as an outline as I go along, but I want to talk to all of you directly. There's different elements or parts of the crime, and first-degree intentional homicide up on the screen has just two parts, two elements, and that is the defendant, in this case Jacob Kerr, caused the deaths of both Sabrina Teague and Hee-san or Sonny Teague. Okay? That's number one. Secondly, that Mr. Kerr acted with intent to kill Sabrina Teague and Hee-san Teague. Those are the only two elements. Okay. The next crime, two elements, two attempted first-degree intentional homicide involved Joel Kennedy. And that is that Mr. Kerr intended to kill Joel Kennedy. Second, that the defendant, Mr. Kerr, in this case, did acts towards the commission of the crime of first-degree intentional homicide, which demonstrate unequivocally, under all the circumstances, that the defendant intended to kill and would have killed Joel Kennedy, except for the intervention of another person or some extraneous factors. For example, in this case, it can be other factors like medical people attending to him, him running away from the scene, him locking himself in the bathroom, other factors like that. Otherwise, the elements are all complete. That's why it's charged as an attempt. The next crime is burglary. And I know most of you don't think of this case as a burglary type of case, right? You might think, well, what burglary? Most people think of burglary as breaking or going into somebody's house without permission and stealing. In this case, burglary is also, number one, that Mr. Kerr intentionally entered that dwelling, entered the house. Number two, that Mr. Kerr entered the dwelling without the consent of the person in lawful possession. Obviously, in this case, that fits when he broke in through a window and committed these crimes. And that, of course, that he knew, Mr. Kerr knew the entry was without consent, obviously. And then this part, the defendant, Mr. Kerr, entered that dwelling with intent to commit first-degree intentional homicide. And that is that Mr. Kerr intended to commit the first-degree intentional homicide at the time he entered, when he went in, when he went through the window. That's what he intended to do. And finally, the elements of the crime of bail jumping. In this case, you heard that Mr. Kerr was charged with a crime in two separate files, and then he was, number two, released from custody on bond, and they intentionally failed to comply with the terms of the bond. Those are the parts of bail jumping. And I wanted to start off with that just at the very beginning to just outline those are the parts of these crimes. Next, the evidence. I don't know exactly what the defense is going to argue here, but I anticipate that there's not going to be a lot of argument that somebody killed intentionally Heason and Sabrina Tate. And again, I think it would be absurd if there's an argument that somebody didn't intend to kill them. Okay, and that's based just even looking at the injuries involved, number one. Okay, I think the argument, again, I think is going to be that Mr. Kerr isn't the one that did this. But I anticipate you might hear that somebody intended to kill them based on these injuries. Okay? No doubt at all. And I'm going to go through, you heard the autopsy information from Dr. Vincent Tranchita. He does a good job. He did a good job, I think, of explaining everything, going very slowly, explaining it, even though it's very graphic to have to hear those things. He did the autopsy first with Sabrina. And Sabrina had stab wounds, actual stab wounds to the cheek. You remember hearing about how it actually, from a stab wound to the cheek, actually injured her tongue. A stab wound to the chin, to the torso area, a stab wound to the base of the neck, a stab wound by the left side of her clavicle, a stab wound in the middle of the left clavicle with injuries to her ribs, her lung, the sac, the pericardial sac that goes around the heart, and the aorta. There's a stab wound of the sternum, which injured her sternum, her ribs, that's lining around the pericardial sac around the heart, and actually injured the right ventricle of her heart. There was a stab wound to the middle area of the abdomen that went into her liver. There was a stab wound to the left side upper part of her back. A stab wound to the right side, more of the middle of the back. And a stab wound to the left side, lower part of the back, which went and damaged her kidney. There's no doubt at all that there was intent to kill. Just based on those injuries. One of the stab wounds you heard about in a moment, I'm going to warn you, I'm going to show you some photographs in a moment. And one of the stab wounds was labeled, you'll see it, letter E. E is in Edward. And that stab wound was like on her right side, upper part of her chest. And that one went down, you know, so it went down and went all the way into her heart from over here. There were more than just stab wounds. You heard about incised wounds. Remember how the doctor explained an incised wound is more like a cut almost on the skin. It's not as deep as it is length. And he described incised wounds to the head of Sabrina, to the neck. I think you remember that one. There was a bad incised wound to her neck, gaping on the side of her neck. There was more than that, too. There was blunt force trauma. There was abrasions to her head, to her torso. There was contusions to her upper extremities, like her arms. You know, he described upper extremities. I refer to them as arms, from your shoulder to your hands. And then finally, the doctor indicated that as a result of everything that he had reviewed, the autopsy and all of his review of it, everything, that there was no doubt about cause of death. It was stab wounds to the head and torso. And then the manner of death is homicide. Again, there's no doubt at all that this is an intentional homicide to her. Just based on that, on the injuries, and the multiple. Can we go to the next one? I'm going to show the photo of Sabrina. You can see those stab wounds that I just talked about on the torso area, to her face, the one that went into her cheek, into her tongue. You can see that one that I talked about that's up towards kind of above in the right part of her chest. I think it's in letter E. And that went all the way to the other side where her heart was, too. And it had to go in a downward motion. The next slide I'm going to show you is another one you saw during the trial. And it's a close-up of that letter E, that wound, the stab wound, I should call it. And it shows you what happened, the injuries to Sabrina. And then finally, the next photo were the stab wounds to the back that I just talked about, that Dr. Tranquita described, and also that significant incised wound to the left side of her neck that you can see in that photo. Next, you heard about the autopsy to Hee-Sun, and I'm going to call her Sunny. And so Sunny, which most people called her, there can be no doubt at all that there was someone intended to cause her death, okay? I want you to just look at the injuries that were described to her, that happened to her. Again, stab wound, actual stab wound to the head, to the scalp area. Torso stab wound to the left breast area. Injuries to the left breast, rib, pericardial sac around the heart, and actually damaged her heart. Stab wound. Incised wounds we described earlier. Actually, a part of her ear, her left ear, was cut off, it looked like. Incised wound to the left side of her forehead, to her left cheek, to her jawline. Neck injuries. Remember the doctor described the neck injuries. He described like a furrow around her neck. A furrow is like a line or like a small ditch area, they call it. A furrow sometimes is a ditch area. It's a furrow from a ligature, from something like a rope or a cord that could be used when someone is strangled. In addition, the doctor talked about that there was indications that there was two ways that she had her neck damaged. From that rope, but there was also evidence of manual strangulation. So when you actually use your hands, for example, when somebody's that angry, and that out of control, and to strangle somebody, there was damage, he talked about, to the different strap muscles on the neck. It's more consistent also with strangulation with the hands or something manually in that way. That blunt force trauma to the head. And then finally, the fractures to her skull, Her nose, her jaw, her sternum was actually fractured. Ribs, her spine, and her fingers. I mean, there can't be any doubt based on that that someone intended to kill her with those injuries. And the doctor went through also all of the different, and I'm not going to go through all that again today, the different abrasions on her body, to her head and neck, contusions to her head and neck, lacerations, torso abrasions, contusions, the upper extremities, arms and legs, abrasions, contusions, the right upper extremity, again, extremities all over her body, basically all over her body, contusions, lacerations. Remember the doctor even said that at one point she was hit so hard to the head, it fractured her, like the orbitals, the part around your eyes, and another part in her skull too, the lower part of the skull as well, he talked about. There was a different part of the skull that was fractured besides the frontal areas. Now, at the end of his testimony, I asked him, what's the cause of death? And he included stab wounds to the torso, blunt force trauma to the head, torso, and extremities, and compression to the neck. And he described it in two different ways. Manner of death, homicide. So both causes of death are both of Sabrina and Sonny. And also the manner of death in each one, for both of them were homicide. Now, I started with that to just get that out of the way because, again, I don't think you're going to hear that there was any doubt. I think the defense is, I think, that somebody killed them and intentionally killed them. But I think the defense is it wasn't Mr. Kerr. The other thing, I'm going to show up one more photo. This photo is of Sonny. You already saw it. You know, to prove cause of death, sometimes we don't know what was used to kill somebody. And in this case, it's pretty clear what was used to brutally beat and over again Sonny. And the best illustration, unfortunately, of that is this picture that has the circle. And you can clearly see, like, from the rounded end of the tire iron. And then you can even see, if you look like we did in court earlier, the close-up of inside the circle, the kind of straight edges of the hexagonal shape that you would use, like normally use a tire iron to take off, you know, nuts on the car wheels or something like that. And he also, you can tell that she was, the doctor said, this was consistent, this tire iron being used, obviously, because of, remember he talked about the crescentic shape? Sometimes you don't have a complete circle like that, but some of the injuries on her body or head, I had that half shape, where you might have the end of that tire iron, for example, that had the circle on it, hitting in a way that would cause the crescentic or like a crescent moon shape. So with Sonny, it's not only clear that somebody intended to kill her and did kill her, because of the injuries, it's very easy to prove in this case, and the evidence shows that there was intent to kill. But also, it looks like there was two different weapons probably used on, with Sonny. There was stab wounds, and there was also the blunt force trauma as well. Next, you might not have this in some cases, but in this case, the state has an eyewitness who saw what happened. And Joel Kennedy was there. And he said, he described how he worked that evening at Burger King. He had his Burger King shirt on with the little insignia, the round circle. It becomes significant later because it's consistent with what Mr. Kerr remembers. And he had his girlfriend Sabrina pick him up at work eventually. And they went to Walmart. He said life was good and that he... For he and Sabrina, things were looking good, looking forward for life. They were going to, I think, get some movies or something at Walmart, and they were just going to come home. Interesting to watch a movie. And they came home, and then he had to face the horror of what happened. Now, one of the things I think that was significant is that when Joel and Sabrina are at Walmart, kind of the timeline is important as you think about this case, too. And you heard about how when Joel and Sabrina are at Walmart, I think it was at 7:51 p.m., Joel Kennedy's cell phone is connecting to Wi-Fi at Walmart. 7:51. And at 8:11, there's the 911 call. So that's the amount of time, from 7:51 to 8:11. And, of course, they had to drive from Walmart to this house in Hobart. And you can kind of also tell, for the timeline, if you back up, the timeline when Sonny went to that celebration for cancer survivors at the Rock Garden. And then she left there. She met her friend Kathleen Zeitler. And they hug before she leaves. And that's the last time Kathleen Zeitler saw her friend. And she said she left at about 7:35 p.m. So that's about the timeline when Sonny would have been driving to her place in Hobart. So, again, I don't know what the defense is really going to be about here. But I don't know if they're going to say somebody else did it sounds like. If they're going to try and say that Joel did it or something. But Joel, if they try and say Joel did it, first of all, Joel's got not just a poke to his arm. You saw that injury. He's got a stab wound that goes all the way through his arm and into his chest. And Joel would have had if he... I know it sounds probably absurd based on the evidence, but Joel would have had, I guess, when he got back to the house from sometime between 7:51, but he would have to, drive with Sabrina to the house, and then between whenever he got there, whether it took him 10 minutes to get to the house, he would have had maybe 5, 10, 15 minutes to kill, for no reason, Sonny. And then kill his girlfriend, who he's just coming home with to watch movies for no reason. Kill her, too. And I don't know, what the defense really is. I heard Mr. Kerr said that Joel was, I don't know if they're saying he was.
I'm going to interpose an objection at this time. The state can discuss the evidence as it came in, but making commentary about what the defense will be, I think, is inappropriate for closing.
Well, that's exactly, I think, what's appropriate for closing, Judge. And I only get to talk myself personally in the closing. Mr. Slay is going to hand a rebuttal, but I can anticipate defenses, and I believe that's appropriate. So if they don't argue that, fine. But if they, again, absurdly say that Joel did it because he was in with some other people or something, I guess Joel, I don't know why, he's got a big hole through his arm and into his chest. So it's absurd based on the evidence. And I know everybody knows that. So I'll show you the next screen, and I just want to show you that injury to Joel again, to Joel Kennedy. You can see the injury going through his arm. He's part of some thing here, part of something to do something. That's what happened to him. You can see the wound to his chest and his arm. It's not a little poke. And the evidence doesn't stop there, okay? You have a confession. And you have a very, very lengthy confession, okay? And one of the things that everybody needs to be clear about, too, confessions come in different ways. Sometimes we do it in writing. It's easier to do it in writing if it's real short. And sometimes you have audio or video, so that way you can hear it if it goes to trial. And so in this case, there's a very, very lengthy confession. And you got to see and hear how this came out. I think that's kind of important. Because Zachary Holschbach and Nikki Yonke, both of the sheriff's department at the time, they're not yelling or screaming or trying to get Mr. Kerr. You did this, didn't you? Let's talk about that. Sometimes you see stuff like that in the movies. You get to see how they treated him. Very, very polite. And talked to him very nicely. And in that case, Mr. Kerr was willing to keep talking and talking and talking and talking for hours. And some of the things he said are important because they're corroborated by things that are at the scene that you wouldn't know unless you did it or were there, first of all, and did it. I mean, he provided the map. He drew the map himself. And he put right on the map that he drew and signed his name on it, on where things happened, the, you know, drew the house, drew the three-stall garage, put where they think, where you could probably find the knife. Not a big and again, we find the knife where he says it was. And then where Sabrina would have collapsed, the fence, you got to see the pictures. It's also important about how he, what's important too is, it's fortunate that these sergeants didn't know a lot about the crime scene. Because then sometimes somebody can say, oh, you fed him that information, didn't you? You as a police officer, you told him this is what happened. These officers really didn't know a lot of information. You know, remember at the beginning, they didn't even know the names of people. And so they start to talk to him, and he admits to being, again, consumed with rage. And he describes it, Mr. Kerr, him, as a wave of hell, consumed by this kind of anger. That's the way Mr. Kerr describes himself when he's leaving his house at night. Now, Mr. Kerr today said something about leaving his house the day before or the night before this happened. And I guess he thinks there's 24, 27 hours of time missing where he doesn't know what's going on or he's missing. I think that what, you know, one of the things, when you come into a courtroom, we have all these rules and we have laws. One thing is we use our common sense still. Right? I think I talked to you about that when we were doing voir dire. One of your best tools is just common sense. And he left his house that night, yeah, after he got in an argument with his dad. And his mom was crying. And apparently he believes that he's been wronged in a lot of ways by the world or by several, two, three women involved in his life. And he leaves there with that wave of anger, the wave of hell, and gets on his bike and puts on his headphones and starts listening to some music called Hollywood Undead as he's biking. And I'm sure that anger was building and building, and he described it so we can know what's going on in his head. Remember, he described it was like, I tried to keep the key in the cage, but the key, I must have got out. Like his anger got out, like he tried to hold it in, but he couldn't. It's very disturbing hearing how he describes his anger that night. What he then goes on to describe is no officer mentions to him names of women or things like that. At one point, we played audio clips to give you an idea of some of the, you could hear his words. And he brought up Sabrina T. By he, I mean Jacob Kerr. And he said one time, you heard the audio, I never mentioned her, Sabrina Teague. I don't care to talk about her. She's a piece of shit. That's what his words are. She's trying to blackmail my family. She said I hit her or raped her. And goes on to say something at the very end. She needs to shut the fuck up. Those are his words that he said. Now, remember as they went through the interview, sometimes Sergeant Holschbach would play along with his, you know, try and remember, and Jacob would say different things. I see blood. I see cement or things like that. And Sergeant Holschbach told him, try and remember. And he said, again, it was like a wave of hell. It was sadness, fucking everything. It's the anger. You can see the anger in the injuries. I was biking. I was thinking about how much I had done. And Sergeant Holschbach said, Mr. Kerr, why are you angry? And again, this is his response. Because of women treating me like shit. That's what he said. And as they went on in an interview, talked about different things. Talked about seeing trees at one point. And then again, Sergeant Holschbach didn't know, like he told you about a window and things like that as a point of entry to the house. And then Mr. Kerr would, at least supposedly, he said he could be acting. And he was saying, I remember a window. And then Sergeant Holzschrock would say, what about the window? Tell me, Jake. And then Jake would get a disturbed look in his face. Sabrina's bedroom. I remember the wood in the bedroom. And he said, I attacked Sabrina. Eventually he said, I attacked her. And he mentions a knife and saying something about a knife. It's not my blood, though. And then at one point he continues through this interview and says he thinks the Sabrina incident, at least part of it, he says, I want to say it was in the garage. And again, a lot of these things are corroborated. The window is corroborated. We showed you the pictures of the window. We showed you how it had been damaged. And you know, obviously see with the grass coming in, it looks like that's an entry point that Mr. Kerr broke in. Again, he wouldn't know this unless he's the one that did it. I don't think people kidnapped him or something or whatever his word was for it and then pushed him through the window, broke the window and shoved him through there or something. It's absurd, right? Absurd. He just is going along telling you what he remembers then. He remembers, I think I tried to get into a car, Chevy Cobalt or Malibu. It was a Chevy Cobalt in the driveway. I remember the three-stall garage. And at one point, talked to about Sonny. Sonny's a real nice lady. And he said this. It's unfortunate the way things turned out. It's just unfortunate the way things turned out. Nobody told him that Sonny died at that point or anything like that. And he said, it's unfortunate the way things turned out. Mr. Kerr said, I guess today, well, I was just talking about it's unfortunate when we broke up, Sabrina and I, years ago, even though I'm not mad about that anymore. But he, you know, what makes sense is in the context here, he's talking about what he did. What he did to his son, Sonny. He talks about, again, stabbing Sabrina to the torso and neck, consistent with the injuries that we observe on her body. He remembers a lot of blood. He remembers the plant, the foliage, where the knife was, drew the map, talks about where Sabrina would be located, talks about the fence, it's over by where the knife was. He talks about the bathroom. Again, the way he wants to describe it is, I remember red in the bathroom. And he remembers a chopping motion in the bathroom with another weapon, though, he said. Not a knife, not a hammer, but something like a hammer. I remember that, he said. In this case, we know what he used, the tire iron. He goes on, he recalls a hammer or something like it. He says, well, no, I remember in the bathroom, some other object like that. Then he goes on to remember things like, yeah, I remember my bike. I remember a bike over there. And he said he describes even the color, I think, of the bike. He remembers it's a gray and red bike, I think, and he describes it like a hybrid street bike, kind of mountain bike. You can find them. You know, again, everything, you can make a list of all the things he says that are corroborated. The bicycle, the window. You can go item by item. There's so many. The red blanket. How would he know about a red blanket unless he was inside there and doing this? He said, I remember a red blanket, and I threw it to cover up blood. And you get to see pictures of the red blanket right outside the door where he came out of there in that laundry room area. He remembers suddenly, I remember a shovel. Remember I got hit with a shovel, and I think in the face, he thought. Yeah, I saw his fat lip that he had, too, as well. He remembers washing his feet in a white sink. And he said, well, why are you washing your feet, Jake? Because I just remember they were a mess. There was so much blood on them. Well, we find the socks in the sink, right next to where his son is in the bathtub. And there's the socks in the sink. It's a white sink. You saw that picture of it. You don't have to make assumptions, okay? You can use your common sense and look at all the direct evidence and find the truth. He even talked about, this is disturbing too, it's like, this is like a horror movie, that he turned the shower on. He thinks he turned water on in two showers, but remember when the police came in there and you could even hear it on the body cam? that when they got there, the shower is actually running where he's on, where Sonny is, and so is the sink. Yeah, he's right. He turned both on. He remembers even, he described that a hacking motion in the bathroom, again said, but not a knife. He remembers his shoes he wore, his D.C. shoes. Remember we saw those D.C. shoes, a kind of unique D and kind of C symbol kind of together. I think they were on the tongue of the shoe. You see them in Sabrina's bedroom down the basement right where he came through the window. Then he says he remembers there was a guy. He later says, I think it was a male. He's the shirt guy. And there was a symbol. And he acts like he's continuing to remember it. A symbol. And it was a round oval. And I think it was either Burger King or Subway. Or some, and a kind of shirt like you'd wear when you just got off of work. Well, yeah, we know who that was. We've got a picture of Joel Kennedy's black Burger King shirt with the round oval that says Burger King. I told you, you can go down the list and you can talk about what's on his confession and then see the corroboration from the scene, from the bicycle, the window. I attacked Sabrina. Obviously, you can see some, you know, the attack on her. Something happened with her in the garage. You can see the blood in the garage. See the blood all over. Remember by the lawnmower and all over there? Stabbed her in the neck and torso. Of course, we can see where he stabbed her. She fell outside by the grass. The shirt that Joel was wearing. The chopping motion that we find out later was with a tire iron. The color of the bike. The water running. The red blanket. The shovel. The washing of his feet. You can go on and on to show that what he's saying is what he did based on the corroborating evidence that we find. Some of the physical evidence. We find the knife. We find the tire iron. We find the bicycle. His clothes look like they're covered with blood. His jeans, shoes, socks. He's got some weird mask that I showed to him that he said it's not his. They apparently had on around his neck at one point when they took it off him. The eye holes in it. And then what do we find on his person? We find Sabrina's phone on him. He's got Sabrina's phone. He's got some weird kind of cord. It looks like a rope-like item that he has that was taken off his person. And then his backpack. Okay? I mean, duct tape? The tire iron's got duct tape wrapped all around it. And so does that hammer. Zip ties? These are things, zip ties he's carrying with him to this place. And we've happened by weird coincidence, I guess, according to Mr. Kerr, I bet, that the zip ties, we also find zip ties in the bathroom next to the tub where his son was brutally killed. Knives, gloves, ropes. And we know it, well, he admits that's his backpack, and we have his driver's license in the backpack, too. That's just some of the physical evidence. But then the evidence doesn't stop there. So besides having confession and all the physical evidence and an eyewitness, we've got DNA evidence. Okay. The tire iron. Kerr's DNA and his son, Sonny's, Teague's DNA with the tire iron. The tire iron has Kerr's DNA on it and his son's, Teague's DNA. The knife that we find outside, the one he identified it, he said where we would find it, has Sabrina DNA. As you saw the picture of the knife, it's just covered with a red substance. That's Sabrina's DNA on it. Okay. And Mr. Kerr said, you'll find the knife over by the foliage area, by that fence, across the driveway. And on the palm of his own hands, Sabrina's DNA on the palm of his hands. And it's good that you got to see, we got to see different views of those hands of Mr. Kerr. Remember when the same nurse was talking to him, I don't know what happened at that point, but we showed you a video of when he first got there. Remember that video, there was no sound? They took his hand and turned it over, kind of had his fingers and kind of put it down. I think it was Sergeant Yonke when she was doing that. You get to see It looks like blood all over his hands. Sabrina's blood on his hands, it looks like. The shovel. He remembered the shovel, Mr. Kerr did. And it's got Joel and Sabrina's DNA. Again, if the defense wants to argue, well, something like, well, there's not Mr. Kerr's DNA on it. Well, it looks like there's a red substance on the shovel. And doesn't that make sense that there would be blood of Joel Kennedy on it? Mr. Kennedy had been stuck through the arm. You saw his injury. He runs out to the garage to get the shovel. Of course, it makes sense there's going to be some of his blood on it. Mr. Kerr, you got to see his injuries, or I guess lack of injuries. His fat lip, what did he got? It probably makes sense, too, that Sabrina's DNA, it's a shovel from the garage at their residence. It's significant that Joel's is on there. Looks like probably his blood's on there from his bleeding all over the place. He said he had to run way to the side, I think, way away from the, when you come out of the garage, into the garage from inside, he had to go way over, he said, to get the shovel. And you saw like a trail of blood, remember, right inside the overhead doors where it would come up if you pulled your car in? Blood going way over there to the side. So, finally, when you look at all of the evidence, ladies and gentlemen, it's almost like a mountain of evidence. And there's no really other conclusion using direct evidence, circumstantial evidence, common sense that points to any other conclusion about what the truth is happening here based on the evidence. That's Sabrina Teague. That's Sonny Teague. Now, after you heard all the testimony of the witnesses, the videos, the audio, the autopsy reports, the map of the scene, the DNA evidence on all the objects, looked at the tire iron, the knife, the backpack, the contents, the bicycle, the items he had on his person, his confession. There is no doubt. There's not just not any reasonable. There's no doubt at all in this case based on the evidence. There's only one verdict for all that makes sense for all of these crimes. And that is Mr. Kerr is guilty of everything he did that night and of every crime he committed these people.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I wanted to start by thanking all of you for paying close attention in this case and for being such good jurors. We know what kind of an inconvenience this is whenever you get called in for jury duty. And we started this case by asking that everybody pay very close attention. And I hope that all of you did pay very close attention. I agree that what happened that night to Sonny and Sabrina is horrible. They certainly didn't deserve what happened to them. It's inexplicable. It's sad. I don't think there's anybody here who doesn't feel that emotion. I certainly do, and I can understand that, and I appreciate that. I think the state, I want to compliment the fact that I think this was presented in a way that allows you to see the evidence or the lack of evidence, but you know, we didn't have to see some of the horrible pictures, and it was a horrible, horrible thing that happened here. I don't think anybody here would suggest that there was anything other than a homicide. There clearly was a homicide that took place, and the question I think that you have to answer as jurors is who's responsible for this crime, who committed this crime. And that's why we asked you to keep an open mind all along in this case, and why we asked you to pay such close attention to the evidence. Because oftentimes we don't know how the state is going to present its case. We oftentimes don't know how many witnesses they're going to call. And it's your job as jurors to sit here and evaluate the various witnesses and decide what weight you want to place on which witness. And different people, when they testify at a trial, have different motivations. Some people have different experiences. And you certainly heard from the state talked a little bit about the autopsy, the doctor who came in here to talk about the significant injuries that happened. Some people have certain expertise, and you should consider that as also when you're listening to these witnesses. And this is my chance to summarize the evidence for you. My remarks are not evidence. The things that I say, you can accept them, you can reject them, you can evaluate how I present things. I try to be candid with you folks with how I think the evidence came in, and I hope that you can give Mr. Kerr the fair consideration that this type of important case requires. It does require a very very thorough consideration of all the evidence. When we go back to the beginning of this trial, it was 3 days ago on Monday when the first witness was called. You heard Joel Kennedy, and I thought some of the things that he said were important in this case. Remember that Mr. Kennedy said that Mr. Kerr had never threatened them, that there would be no reason for Mr. Kerr to be present in that home. He had never seen Mr. Kerr in that house. And I think Joel had said he dated Sabrina for about 7 months, 6 or 7 months at that point. And she had not made any comments about being fearful of Mr. Kerr, having had bad experiences with Mr. Kerr. She wasn't scared of him. She hadn't brought him up. I don't even think Mr. Kennedy really even knew who Mr. Kerr was. He might have heard that. I think the extent of his knowledge of Jacob was there was some sort of incident at Walmart where Joel and Sabrina had crossed paths with Jake. But my understanding of what I heard in this trial was that there was nothing violent during that confrontation, or that when their paths crossed, there was nothing, certainly nothing homicidal or anything of that nature that was exhibited by Jacob. And I do think that some of Joel's testimony was certainly inconsistent. And that's not my characterization of what happened in this case. Joel Kennedy said that. He said that when the state called him. One of the first things he said was that there were inconsistencies when he was preparing for his trial testimony. When he was working with their office, he noticed inconsistencies between what he remembered happening and what he testified to. And so I thought there were quite a few inconsistencies. We discussed those with him. All of you heard those various things. And as a general rule, somebody who is being honest about something tends not to have inconsistencies. Again, goes to our common sense. I also thought it was unusual that one of the last things he had searched on YouTube was famous last words. Of course, in this case, significant quantity of evidence was obtained. Both the Hobart Police Department, the Green Bay, the Oneida Brown County Sheriff's Department, there was considerable evidence that all these departments seized. DCI seized evidence. There were phones. There were hard drives. And Joel Kennedy's phone was examined. And his phone did show that the last thing he had searched right before this very brutal event was famous last words. I think there is a lack of intent in this case. Of course, my comments are simply my observations. I trust that all of you can evaluate the evidence carefully. But I think that there is a lack of intent in this case, that if it was Mr. Kerr who did this crime, why is the huge knife in his backpack still in the backpack? Why wasn't that knife used immediately? It was a very long knife. Mr. Kerr testified to that, and it doesn't make sense that if he's intending to go in this house and slaughter people, he wouldn't have used that knife. No gloves were used. If Mr. Kerr committed this crime, certainly doesn't appear to be any lack of preparation or planning at all, not to have any gloves on. Saw that in his backpack there were in fact gloves. The state made a point of it when he was on the stand today, but he wasn't wearing that. Mr. Kerr testified. We'll get into that in a little bit, but he did take the stand and give his version of events. All of you saw the body cam video of him laying in the woods or laying in the tall grass next to the house. He certainly didn't look like somebody who was actively running from the scene or trying to resist law enforcement actively or fight with law enforcement. Those are all things that we do think guilty people would do. They'd be running away some significant distance, yet he's laying there passed out in the tall grass, appearing to be in some sort of almost catatonic condition or some sort of condition, but he certainly doesn't seem to be in the condition to be committing a murder. I think some of the things coming out of Jacob's mouth at that time are interesting, too. You heard that on the body cam video. But he's not making a whole lot of sense. He's talking about Ike right away, as I recall. And there was Deputy Mueller, I think, was the witness who testified about some of the things that, those utterances that came out of Jacob's mouth, like, Ike, where is he? And I think the deputy even said that Mr. Kerr wasn't making much sense. Again, that's important because sometimes we do have situations where an individual is immediately telling the police, you got me, this is what I did, and they're telling the officers what took place. Here, Mr. Kerr really does appear to be in some sort of state of confusion, some sort of state of anguish, and that's consistent with the theory that he testified to and the version that he gave you folks when he testified, that really there's no reason for him to want to kill Sonny. There's no motive to kill her at all. He said she's a sweet woman. He testified to the fact that she's a sweet woman, and I have no doubt that that's true. I have no doubt that her daughter was a sweet woman as well. But Jacob didn't have a motive to kill them. And that's important because even though the state, they don't have to prove a motive, but we can consider motive when you folks are deliberating and deciding what's important in this case. And I want to talk about Mr. Kerr's testimony because he did take the stand, and I discussed with all of you on Friday of last week about the fact that a defendant does not have to testify. A defendant has a constitutional right not to. All of you said you would honor whatever decision Mr. Kerr made, and I thank you for that, and I thank you for listening carefully when he testified. Jacob is not a professional witness. He's not somebody who has experience like law enforcement officers do coming to court and testifying. He's a citizen. And I think that once state had introduced some clips of the audio that took place over the course of 10 hours, but we should use our common sense and think critically about some of the things that were said in the hospital, because certain things are very clear. Mr. Kerr was attacked by a dog. He was bitten on the leg. He was brought to the hospital, and he was administered ketamine, which is a sedative. It's a dissociative. It's an amnesiac. So he's administered a drug that does have those properties to it. And the state played a few clips. If you add it all up, it's maybe, let's say, 15 to 20 minutes worth of things that Mr. Kerr said over the course of 10 hours. But I thought Mr. Kerr, when he testified, did a fair job of explaining that no, he wasn't confessing to anything at all. In fact, he's maintained his innocence throughout 4 years. He's maintained his innocence even today, and he's presumed innocent. But Mr. Kerr explained that he was making assumptions. So he was giving the police an assumption that if something happened, this is how I believed it happened. And I trust all of you heard that, and you can give that the very important weight that I think that deserves. Mr. Kerr did explain what he is able to recall from that night. He does not have a perfect recollection. I think if he were looking to simply spin a tale, he could have gotten on the stand and he could have concocted from start to finish some version that all the holes are plugged up after he studied all the evidence and he ties everything together and says, I remember everything and here's what happened. But I thought he was very honest when he said, no, much of this is something I don't remember, unfortunately. I do recall being on my bike. I do recall, he used the word ganked, but we know that he means abducted. And he's describing what he does remember, which is somebody, some individual, the state in their closing said, well, what is he suggesting happened? I think if you were listening to his testimony, if they were listening to his testimony, we know what he's saying. Mr. Kerr is saying he didn't commit the crime. Some other people did. And that he was abducted. He was brought to the scene. He's apparently left outside the scene or dragged through the scene and dumped there. And that's why you have his presence, and that's why you have the DNA evidence that you do. But Mr. Kerr was not under the influence of any drugs or any alcohol at all, so whatever happened to him does appear to be some sort of head injury from his abduction. That's what he's told you. Now, the chain is also off his bike. If you remember that piece of evidence, his bike is off to the side with the chain off of it. That's another piece of evidence that suggests that somehow something impacted him or he fell over on his bike, because that's the most logical explanation for why a chain would be off the bike. The state called a DNA expert today. You folks heard that testimony just a few hours ago, so I don't think I need to go into too much detail about it. But I do think the DNA evidence can oftentimes paint a more full picture of both guilt or innocence. And in this case, I think the DNA analyst cut in favor of innocence in some respects, very significantly with the shovel. This was the plastic shovel in the garage that Joel had said he took and he smashed or hit Jacob in the face with the shovel. And yet, we didn't have any of Jacob's DNA at all on that shovel, not on the blade end or the handle end. There weren't any fingerprints at the scene. And I thought very striking, hopefully you'll think the same thing, but I thought it was very striking that when Mr. Kerr's hands were swabbed for purposes of testing for DNA, there was no DNA whatsoever of Sonny, on either his right or his left hand. She was the victim of an extraordinarily brutal event. There was a lot of blood. It was a very violent incident. And yet, Mr. Kerr's hands don't have any of Heason's DNA anywhere on any of the swabs. And I think it's very significant that if he had been involved in this event, we would have expected to see some of her blood somewhere on him. We would have expected to hear that testimony. And I do think a lot of things were taken. It's very clear that a lot of things were taken, but certainly not everything was tested. And trying to figure out what happened is very important. I think it was sloppy not to test everything. I think that in the case of this significance and this importance, we should expect that everything would be tested. And the lack of Heason's DNA anywhere on Mr. Kerr is a very significant point, I think, and underscores the fact that he had nothing to do with her slaying. There was electronic evidence in this case. You heard Mr. Kerr tell the police that it was very important to him. Among other things he said during his initial entrance to the hospital, he did ask the police to, I think Mr. Kerr was on the side of transparency in a lot of ways. It seemed to me that he's read his Miranda rights. He's told he can remain silent. He's told that he can choose to talk or not talk. And he waives those rights and chooses to talk to the police. He made that decision. But what Jacob was saying was, please, by all means, search my phone. Search the USB drives that I have. Examine my Facebook page. Examine my Google drives. And I think all of those things, the inference I think you should draw is that Mr. Kerr's interest in having law enforcement examine all of those things is further evidence of his innocent involvement in this case. That he's the guilty person, I would suggest, would be on the side of hiding evidence and concealing evidence and denying permission to search one's blood, refusing to make a statement, refusing to give turnover Google drives and USB drives. And yet, Mr. Kerr immediately at the very first moments is saying, please examine those things. And there isn't a signed confession either. The state talked about there's different types of things and there's different types of statements. You remember one of the exhibits early on was Joel Kennedy's written statement. Law enforcement had a written statement from Joel Kennedy signed by Joel Kennedy. Similarly, they don't have that from Mr. Kerr. I think the inference one could draw is that if law enforcement thought that Mr. Kerr was confessing, truly confessing to have committed these horrific crimes, that I think, given how open he was about take whatever Google Drive you want, search whatever you want, I would think that you would simply type up the confession or write out the statement to give it to Mr. Kerr to sign. If that's truly what you thought he was saying, if you really thought he was admitting to his involvement in all of this, I believe the next logical step would be, okay, let's write it out, and can you sign it? They had him draw a picture of the house, and the state's made a big deal about that, but he'd been to the house. He dated Sabrina years and years ago, so the fact that he knew the layout of the house or knew that there's three garages or knew that she had a bedroom downstairs, I really don't think that's as significant as the state is trying to make that sound. And again, they're asking you to draw inferences. Well, when he circled a particular area, that means you were chasing her through that area. But I don't remember hearing that statement played to you. Again, your recollection controls. If I missed it, I missed it. But I don't recall that specific statement being played to you. And I don't think that what Mr. Kerr was really saying during this 10 hours of ongoing discussion was that I committed this crime. I think the history of this case has shown, and I think his position has been unyielding, that he didn't commit the crime. And I don't think guilty people offer up all that evidence to police and do the things that he did. As the judge indicated to you just shortly before the state began their presentation, the state's burden is to prove this case beyond a reasonable doubt, which is the highest burden in the land. There are other burdens in the law that are much lower burdens and much easier standards for one to meet, but proof beyond a reasonable doubt is the absolute highest burden that exists under the law. And I think we read jury questions, all of you filled out jury questionnaires, and we were able to learn a little bit about all of you before the trial, and we appreciate that because all of you said that you would follow the law. And the most important thing to us throughout this case has been ensuring that we have a group of people that will follow the law. The law requires a verdict of not guilty if the state has failed to meet its burden. And we think that they failed to meet their burden for all the reasons we've set forth here. and we trust that you'll reach that conclusion on all counts. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cotton. Mr. Lassay?
Thank you, Your Honor, and I reiterate what Mr. Johnson said. Thank you for your attention here today, and what Mr. Cotton said as well. We appreciate that you have participated in this process to this point, and I apologize that you have to hear one more person thrown on. But because we have that burden of proof, because the state has an obligation to prove each element of these crimes beyond a reasonable doubt, we go last. We have an opportunity to have the last word, to rebut whatever it is that the defense presents to us, and to ensure that you have a full and complete understanding of this case, and you can be prepared to enter what, in my view, in this case, is the only possible verdict. I applaud Mr. Cotton for doing the best that he can with a case that he was given. Didn't talk a lot about the specifics of the facts in this case because there isn't a lot to talk about from the defense perspective. This case involves a mountain of evidence supporting conviction. When on earth do you have an eyewitness, a defendant found on scene covered in blood, 15 to 20 items of physical evidence corroborating everything that the defendant said in a recorded confession, and the defendant's DNA on the murder weapon? This case is cut and dry. It is as clear as it gets. It is proof beyond a reasonable doubt and then some. Any suggestion from Mr. Kayer that he was ganked, kidnapped, or abducted by some random people and brought to this scene and just happened upon a death scene is absurd. It is offensive to your intelligence, and it has no place in a court of law. Maybe he can tell his story on Google. Maybe he can tell his story on Facebook or to whatever kind of cable network he can get on to hear him out. But that has no place in a court of law. In a court of law, we base our decisions on facts, on evidence, on reason and logic. And none of those support anything in this case other than guilt beyond a reasonable doubt to all counts. When I heard Mr. Cotton mention in his closing a few things, I want to touch on those. He talked about Joel Kennedy and Joel's testimony and talking about some of the inconsistencies in Joel's testimony. You'll hear jury instruction 300, which is credibility of witnesses. And you can assess which witnesses are telling the truth. And that jury instruction outlines for you with specificity what credibility of witnesses should entail. One, whether a witness has an interest or lack of interest in the result of this trial. Joel Kennedy's only interest in the result of this trial is that the person who stabbed him through his arm into his chest be held accountable for his conduct. Mr. Kayer has every interest in the world in lying to you here today. He wants to go home. He wants to be acquitted of these horrendous offenses that he's committed. The witness's conduct, appearance, and demeanor on the witness stand. Ask yourself as you compare Joel Kennedy to Jacob Kayer, whose demeanor was more truthful? Whose conduct on the witness stand was more appropriate? The clearness or lack of clearness of the witness's recollection. Jacob Kayer himself told you he doesn't remember a darn thing from June 6th until he wakes up in the hospital. He has no recollection, according to what he said on the stand here today. None. So whatever he said here today about the events that happened that night, completely incredible. Joel Kennedy remembered to the best of his recollection, and were there some minor inconsistencies? Absolutely. What does a person do when they're confronted with their inconsistencies? A truthful person owns up to those inconsistencies. He says, yeah, you know, I noticed this in my statement, but this is what I remember here today. And that's what Joel Kennedy did. What does Mr. Kayer do? He gets defensive. He gets argumentative. He gets angry. He flips off the prosecutor. There's no credibility to Jacob Kayer, none whatsoever. What about the opportunity for the witness to observe and know the matters testified? Joel Kennedy was right there. He knows exactly what happened. And the physical evidence, again, corroborates Joel's own testimony. Mr. Kayer talks about a poke going in Joel's arm and a tiny amount of blood. Why didn't Joel just get up and, you know, I would have stayed on top of him and hurt him. He put a knife through his arm into his chest. He intended to kill him. And Joel Kennedy got his arm up. And that butcher knife went all the way through his arm and into his chest. And there's blood all over the floor, completely consistent with what Joel talked about. And then ask yourself another factor, the reasonableness of a witness's testimony. How reasonable was Mr. Kayer's testimony? that some random individuals with whom he has a feud kidnapped him, carried him around in a car for a few days, dropped him at a scene, and killed two innocent people and tried to kill a third? For what? To get back at him? That's an absurdity. There's no reasonableness to his testimony whatsoever. Likewise, there's no reasonableness to his testimony here today that all of the specific details he provided in the course of an 8-hour interview with law enforcement are now somehow inaccurate. And what do we know about that confession? And Mr. Cotton says, oh, there's no signed confession. Why would you need a signed confession? You have 8 hours of recorded video. You have Mr. Kerr stabbing and demonstrating his stabbing on a recorded video. Why do we need a signed confession? We know what was said. And I know that they want to ask you to draw suppositions from the things that weren't presented in court. You aren't supposed to draw suppositions from things that aren't mentioned in court. You're supposed to rely on the evidence that is presented to you. Did you hear anything about Jacob Kerr's G Drive, Google Drive? Did you hear anything about Jacob Kerr's Facebook page? Did you hear portions of the video? Are there portions of the video that you didn't hear? If you didn't hear about them, you don't draw conclusions about them. You don't know whether Jacob Kerr's hard drive or Facebook page, all of which he mentioned is a public profile. You can't draw a supposition that that would be helpful to Mr. Kerr. If it was helpful to Mr. Kerr, why wouldn't they have played it? It's a public profile.
Appropriate.
I don't believe it's burden shifting when he specifically argued that we failed to show it information that was testified to as being open to the public.
It mischaracterizes my argument.
I'm going to overrule the objection.
And my point isn't that they contain one thing or the other. My point is you can't draw a conclusion about what's on there. Don't assume that we intentionally withheld information like Mr. Kerr says. That's absurd. We presented to you a streamlined case based on overwhelming facts supporting his guilt. We presented to you the important information that you needed to know to make the decision that you can make. You are logical, reasonable, intelligent people who know that an eyewitness, a confession, physical evidence found on scene on Mr. Kerr's person and by the crime lab, and the DNA corroborating his signed statement and his eyewitness. That's all you need. That's all anyone would need. That's more than anyone would need. This burden of proof, we own this burden of proof. We live by this burden of proof. It is absolutely a pillar of the criminal justice system that we must prove each element of the offenses beyond a reasonable doubt. But a reasonable doubt is not a doubt based on guesswork or speculation. It's not a doubt that arises on sympathy. I don't know how you feel about Mr. Kerr and how he testified here today and whether you're concerned about his condition or frankly, I don't want you to do it based on sympathy for the victim either. But a reasonable doubt is not a doubt that may be used to escape the responsibility of a decision, and you have a difficult decision on 2 counts of intentional homicide and a 3rd count of attempted homicide. You are to give him the benefit of every reasonable doubt, but you're not to search for the guilt. You're to search for the truth. And you can only find, it's not a reasonable doubt unless it's based on a reasonable hypothesis consistent with the defendant's innocence. And there's no reasonable hypothesis presented to you. None whatsoever. The only reasonable hypothesis is that Jacob Kerr turned 1368 Riverdale Drive into a modern day real life horror story. His wild, unsupported conspiracy theories that fly in the face of overwhelming evidence supporting his guilt have no place in this courtroom. They belong in a fictional horror story, not the real life horror story that he created. As Mr. Johnson detailed for you, and I won't dwell on too many of these things, but Mr. Kerr's statement includes all of this information that the law enforcement officers had no way of knowing at that time. And I know he wants to tell you that this was all me getting fragments and pictures of my mind, and I couldn't see and I couldn't understand, and I was all just guessing. You were guessing on the location where you were at, Teague's residence. You were guessing on the manner of entry into Sabrina's bedroom. You were just supposing that you were swinging a hammer-like object in the bathroom. You were supposing that maybe you turned 2 showers on because the shower was on and the water was on. You were supposing that there was blood everywhere, as there is. You were just guessing that you were washing your socks and your feet in the sink, which perfect explanation for why there's no DNA on his feet, why his son's Teague's DNA isn't on him. He's washing it off. Washed his feet in the sink, washed his socks in the sink, washed his hands in the sink. Before he committed the second murder, didn't have a chance to wash it off before law enforcement got to him the second time. But just thank God Joel Kennedy survived and called the police, and they were able to get to the scene where they found the murderer on site covered in blood. He was guessing that he stabbed Sabrina and that she fell in the foliage and that the knife was right there by the driveway. It's just his supposition that there was fighting in the garage and that he was hit in the face with a shovel, and we find a shovel in the garage amidst all this blood and chaos, covered in blood. It's supposition that he was trying to get into Sabrina's car and we find the bloodstains on the handle and on the car. But there's a red blanket that his bike is on scene. This isn't conjecture or supposition. This is a person who maybe doesn't want to own up to his own actions. Doesn't want to admit to himself that he had that anger, that his anger boiled over, that it came out, that he was that jack-in-the-box ready to explode, riding to that scene on his bike in anger, in hell, just as he described it. And that anger and that hell, that unloaded on Sabrina Teague and on Sonny Teague. You saw those crimes. You heard those injuries. It's horrific, and I'm not going to detail them. I can't. But those were done by an angry, angry human being. Someone who had gone through hell, whose anger had welled up, who could no longer control themselves. They had to have their anger come through. That was Jacob Kayer. And all 6'3 of Jacob Kayer, as he likes to describe himself, came down with that knife. Imagine the force necessary to take that butcher knife from the top of Sabrina's chest down into her heart.
I'm gonna object at this point as being beyond the scope of rebuttal. So they're just giving a second closing. It's not rebutting anything I said.
I'm almost done.
I'm gonna allow him to continue and finish his argument.
That is intent. That is intent. Intent to kill by a man with so much rage and so much anger, just like Jacob describes, for all these people that have wronged him. Dylan, Wendy, Nicole, Sabrina, his dad, the police, the state. We're all wrong. Everybody else is wrong. He's right. Even when his opinion isn't supported by reality or rationality or any of the evidence in this case. I ask you to carefully consider the evidence and return the only possible verdict, and that is that Jacob Kayer is guilty of all 6 of these counts. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lissay. All right, we're back on the record in State of Wisconsin versus Jacob Kayer, case number 2016 CF902. The appearances remain the same as they did earlier today. I'm told that the jury has reached a verdict. Now, I just want to remind, it doesn't look like we have very many people here that I'm concerned about, but I just want to remind everybody that we have been at this for a few days. The jury is about to return their verdict consistent with our system of justice, and I would ask everyone to just take a moment to remember that we're in a courtroom, and I'm going to ask that there be no outbursts or disturbances of any kind that might affect the jury. Depending on their verdict, we may be going to a second phase, and I don't want the jury in any way affected by anything that might happen here today. They've been very conscientious, very hardworking, very diligent, so I'd ask you to be mindful of that as they return to the courtroom and we learn of their decision in this case. Please stand for the jury. Please be seated. The jury has returned to the courtroom. Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, have you reached a verdict?
Yeah.
Would you please hand the verdict to the bailiff? The verdicts appear to be in proper form, and I will read the verdicts at this time. State of Wisconsin versus Jacob Kayer. We, the jury, find the defendant, Jacob P. Kayer, guilty of first-degree intentional homicide of Sabrina O. Teague, as charged in count one of the information, dated at Green Bay, Wisconsin, this 12th day of August, 2020, signed by the foreperson. State of Wisconsin versus Jacob P. Kayer. We, the jury, find the defendant, Jacob P. Kayer, guilty of the first-degree intentional homicide of his son, Teague, as charged in count two of the information dated at Green Bay, Wisconsin, this 12th day of August, 2020, signed by the foreperson. State of Wisconsin versus Jacob P. Kerr, we the jury find the defendant Jacob P. Kerr guilty of the attempted first-degree intentional homicide of Joel Kennedy as charged in count three of the information dated at Green Bay, Wisconsin, this 12th day of August, 2020, signed by the foreperson. State of Wisconsin versus Jacob P. Kerr, we the jury find the defendant Jacob P. Kerr guilty of burglary as charged in count four of the information dated at Green Bay, Wisconsin, this 12th day of August, 2020, signed by the foreperson. State of Wisconsin versus Jacob P. Kerr, we the jury find the defendant Jacob P. Kerr guilty of bail jumping as charged in count five of the information dated at Green Bay, Wisconsin, this 12th day of August, 2020, signed by the foreperson. State of Wisconsin versus Jacob P. Kerr, we the jury find the defendant Jacob P. Kerr guilty of bail jumping as charged in count six of the information dated at Green Bay, Wisconsin, this 12th day of August, 2020, signed by the foreperson. Before I accept the verdicts, I'll ask the jury if this verdict is your verdict and ask the jurors to raise their hands. If yes, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, is this your verdict? Everyone has raised their hand. Thank you. Do the attorneys want the jurors individually polled?
No, thank you, Judge.
Thank you.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Experience holiday cheer at Tanger Outlets with savings up to 70% off your favorite brands. From fragrances to accessories and the latest styles, discover the best gifts for everyone on your list. Save big at Nike Factory Store, Michael Kors, Under Armour, Coach, Polo Ralph Lauren, Kate Spade New York, and so many more. Unwrap the best at Tanger Outlets. Hundreds of brands, endless gifting options. Plan your trip at Tanger.com.